Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. This hour, we're airing highlights from our March Get Lit with All of It book club event, and it's time to close out with some music, as we always do. Our book club selection this month was the novel No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. But Patricia has been talking about someone, and that someone turned out to be the perfect musical guest to cap off our evening. Here's a tweet Patricia wrote about musician John Darnielle, posted September 10th, 2015 at 1:05 a.m. Most people will tell you that music is bad, but tonight, the way the Mountain Goats played it, it's not. John Darnielle is an acclaimed songwriter and a National Book Award-nominated novelist. He's been recording for 30 years as the Mountain Goats, and Rolling Stone has called him one of rock's best storytellers. And to bring this all full circle, we're going to hear a performance from John that was inspired by a tweet. Here's John Darnielle, a.k.a. the Mountain Goats, performing Picture of My Dress, from his latest album, Getting Into Knives, from our Get Lit Book Club event.
Here at a truck stop in New Mexico, just before dawn, somebody's grandma behind the wheel of a big rig, pulling in with her headlights on. We smoke a cigarette as the sunrise runs riot. Someone's got to break the quiet. She says, what are you doing here anyway? And I smile and say, you'd never guess. She holds it up for me by its skinny white shoulder straps. Well, I take a picture of my dress. I take a picture of my dress. I'm here in the bathroom. Of a Dallas, Texas Burger King. And Mr. Steven Tyler is on the overhead speakers. And he doesn't want to miss a thing. Back there at the counter, blending in with the lunchtime crowd, trying not to laugh out loud. I eat half my crispy chicken club. I get extra mayonnaise, it's a mess. I take the other half back to the parking lot with me, pop the trunk. Take a picture of my dress. I take a picture of my dress. It still looks good. I only wore it once. Nine years and 7 months. It may be a long time before the highway relents and finally sets me free. I'm gonna have to chase down the remnants of something special that you stole from me. It may be hiding in the sunset or in distant corners of the dawn. Or maybe it's gone. I say some prayers above the engine. I bless everything there is to bless. Run out of gas in the middle of nowhere anywhere. And then I stand there by the roadside, smiling. I take a picture of my dress. I take a picture of my dress. I take a picture of my dress.
That was John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats performing Picture of My Dress from our March Get Lit with All of It book club event. Since our Get Lit selection, the novel No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood, is so much about life online, I started my conversation with John by asking him about the internet. I wanted to know how the rise of the internet had affected John's life and his livelihood as a musician.
Well, I mean, I met my wife on a mailing list, you know, back in the days of mailing lists. So and that was before, that was like right before what I think was called the eternal September. Do you know this term?
I don't. Tell me. Teach me.
So in the first years of the internet, of Usenet, right, and mailing lists, every September, the discussions that you'd been having all summer that were kind of great would just go to hell. And it would be because a bunch of people had gone to college, right? And they would arrive to the discussion going, I got this one. I know this one, right? And pick fights and get in fights and didn't know how to sort of be in the flow, right? And that was every September. And then suddenly all the colleges were online and the whole discourse became the eternal September. So, where it's like now it's just going to be like this all the time. The number of people buying in every month is so huge that it'll never get back to this. But the thing is, that's an elitist position, and I don't believe in that position. Right? It's a gatekeeping elitist position. Mm-hmm. And this is similar to, like, it does feel like Twitter was at one point a point where there was a cool kids club doing a cool thing, but I'm very suspicious of any claims that the scene was once cool and now it's not, right? Because it's sort of like there's a line in ecclesiastical thinking that, like, you know, if you want to find a perfect church, go join it. But understand that as soon as you join it, it's no longer a perfect church, right? And that's the, you know, that's the thing. It's like, yeah, it was, Twitter was a little cooler when there was less stuff going around. But at the same time, like, as a tool for broadening knowledge of social justice and stuff like that, it's done over the past couple of years way more good than it was doing when it was some of us making some really funny jokes. When videos of police violence go viral and it results in accountability or theoretically in some justice, we hope, you know, that's a huge positive and it's for sure worth trading the cool times we had for, you know. So I always try to think about that. I'm always, you know, because I come from music scenes and music scenes all go through this period of Eden where it's like, this scene is the coolest and you always know. And it won't be the coolest. Somebody, a couple people are going to find it. It won't be as cool as it was. But that's okay because maybe those people will start bands that are great, even if the scene sort of suffers. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the flow. I sound like a hippie. I'm a hippie.
It's all right. We're pro-hippie around here. So you put out two albums in 2020.
Yes.
And they sound completely different.
Yes.
One was recorded on a boombox and the other's with the full band. How did it feel to kind of go back to the sort of origins, sort of like stripped down, boombox, just you?
It was a lot of fun. It was, you know, we were talking in the previous segment about self-consciousness. And that's like, that's one reason I don't like to do anything that sort of already has a backstory, if I can help it. You know, it's like, so going back to the boombox, sort of, there's a point of comparison there. I'm older and I'm a better songwriter now, but that comes at the expense of the immediacy of these, you know, those early recordings. When you hear me, do you play music?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. So you know what the four is going from the tonic to the four?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In those early recordings, when I go to the four, I have Columbus syndrome. I'm like, look what I discovered. It's like, I am the first person alive to play this G after a D. Am I amazing or what? You know, and that was my vibe. Then every time I would go to the four, I'd feel like I found God, you know? Well, I mean, I still feel that way about the four, but it's not that feeling of like, what have I done? I can do it too. I can play this thing, you know? And so sooner or later, once you trade the joy of your own personal discovery for expertise. And that's a common story, right? And it's a story that it's why a lot of bands' first albums are their best ones, because that's when everybody can't believe they're doing the thing, you know? But so it's one reason I didn't go back for a long time. But when we got home from recording and it was clear to me that we wouldn't be going out, and we plan, I mean, this is our day job, right? There's seven of us who draw a paycheck from this, and I feel a profound sense of responsibility to them. I'm not the boss, but I'm the masthead. I'm the face at the front of the ship, you know, for better or worse. And so I felt like, you know, I got to do something that gets us a little bit of money, you know, before we go back out on the road in 3 months. That was my thinking. Right?
Well, it didn't work out that way.
But the one that we were recording before we came home was called Getting Into Knives. But so, yeah. So when I got home, I got out my old boombox. For people who don't know my work or our work, but the Mountain Goats began when I lived in employee housing at Metropolitan State Hospital. And I was... I had a big court case to pay off, but I was still making a decent living for the first time in my life. And I didn't have a TV. It was not a decent enough living to buy a TV, but it was decent enough to buy a boombox. So I started just recording these. I wrote poetry at the time. I started setting my poems to very simple chord progressions and singing them out loud. And I discovered the immediacy of recording the boombox, and the sound of the tape was really pleasing to me. And that's how, over time, that snowballs into it becoming my job. There are people for whom those early recordings have a charm and a depth and a power that can't really be matched once it becomes a more complex, a more tailored sort of thing. Because those are all recorded within seconds of having been written, or they're recorded during the writing. And then that went away over time. We became a band. We started working in studios. And then when I got home, I had an idea for a new album. There was no reason to really do anything but get started on it. So I started tracking to the boombox, and I wrote one on a Monday, and then the next day I wrote another one. And I thought, well, and this is how my brain works. I thought, well, what if I just keep doing this until I have 10? I'll do one a day. The thing is, like, if you're in the zone, you can do that. You know, it's like, I do think for me, not for everybody maybe, but for me, the more I work, the more I'm liable to work well. Eventually, it takes a pretty heavy toll on my mental health and on other people's ability to tolerate me, right? Because you get into this writing, creating at any level is narcissism to some extent, and it doesn't tend to make good people of us, right? We have to, most artists, I think, have to work, if they want to be good people, to incorporate that goodness part of themselves into the part that's standing here going, you know, I mean, if you want to be on a microphone anywhere, there's something about you that says, hey, I'm cool, I have something to say. That even people who have no interest in my success can benefit from. Right? It's like there's a degree of ego in there, right? And so I'm always trying to grapple with that. But when you get into that zone, for me anyway, the more I work, the more I'm going to produce. If I do it for 2 or 3 weeks, my brain gets to boiling and I won't be able to sleep. And I've never really chased it longer than that because it gets really unhealthy inside there. But it feels good at the time. I mean, I feel it's a low-level mania, I think. So.
You wrote a novel called The Wolf in the White Van. Is that right?
Wolf in White Van. I have...
Wolf in White Van.
Right behind me, here's the Italian edition of it. It's called Il Lupo nel Furgo di Bianco. Yeah, that was the first one. The second one was called Universal Harvester.
Did you try to write during COVID? Did you try to sit down and write another novel?
Oh, I mean, I've been working on a novel for the past 5 or 6 years. So yeah, I've been... It made it so much harder because I have 2 children. So normally they go to school and I go to my office, right? Well, that came to a grinding halt, and I'm literally, you can't see this, but on the floor now is the stuff I'm revising. I'm in home stretch on that book, and I'm really excited.
Oh, wow.
And I'm working on it every day, but I'm not getting the kind of 8-hour days I would get if I was going to the office. This is my home office, but there's 2 children out there.
It's so funny the way you talk about it. They're out there. There's children.
They
out
are.
There.
They're right there. It's like they're always right out there.
I know you love them. So we were actually just having a great conversation about what we like to read.
Yeah.
You show our readers what you're into right now.
This is my new find is Elio Vittorini, and this is a early New Directions hardback. Not that early, but 50s. But look at the Directions series. Mm-hmm. So there's this list of other books in the series, and I'm totally addicted to that. Like, oh, what else is there? I could have all of them if I wanted to collect them. I'm a bad collector, but still half of them are by people I've never heard of. And then the others are by like Sartre, Kenneth Rexroth, Raymond Cano, Boris Pasternak, but also, Giuseppe Berto, a book called The Works of God. Now, this was good enough for New Directions in 51, so I bet it's an interesting book. You know, I'm a huge book junkie as far as like, I like to know about the little byways of books and sub imprints and stuff like that. That's sort of my zone.
How have you been dealing with your, how have you been getting your fix during COVID when, I mean, going through bookstores is one of the great pleasures of life.
Well, yeah, and especially I live on tour, so I can tell you where I go to Detroit. I go to John King Books. I don't know if you've ever been to John King, but like, you know, I go to Portland and I go to Powell's, a place I've been going to since the 80s. Everybody knows about Powell's. But then, like, last time I was in Vancouver, BC, I found like 3 bookstores on one walk, and they were all so good. But now I order from my local, from the regulator. But I do also an online thing called A Libris that connects with used bookstores, right? And you can find anything on there in all kinds of conditions. And that's where I got that. I read Vitorini. I was like, well, I'm going to need the rest of this guy's books. So I got them. And then they were probably like, there's a good chance that I don't actually read that for another 5 years or maybe ever. But there's an essay by, I want to say it's Garcia Marquez, but I'm not sure. About how it's not about whether you read the books. It's that when you have books, they all represent possible versions of yourself. You know, mm-hmm. like there's the me who's reading that one and now knows something about that, you know. And especially with nonfiction books, I never even finish them. I'm a fiction guy, you know. But I have all these nonfiction books that I think, oh yeah, maybe someday I will be able to tell you something about that.
So. You were kind enough to send us another track. This one is called Short Song About the 10 Freeway.
Old song.
Old song. Is that pretty much self-explanatory?
So, I mean, this is, I was talking about the how those old songs were about urgency, right? Just the urgency of the mm-hmm. writing. I mean, it's like one thing that I liked. And again, it's like by the time I record this, I'm studying English at Pitzer and I'm deep in theory. I'm thinking about what is writing, all these kinds of things, you know, why does one write, all these questions you sort of stop asking yourself once it's your gig and then you just do it. But I was like, I wanted a song to bear evidence of its own creation, right? I wanted you to be able to hear how it felt to be writing it, right? Okay. That is not really, in literature, that's usually not going to be good, but in song, it can get there, right? It's like you can do something. I mean, obviously, in improvisational jazz, that's what it's about. It's like you do something and it's never been done before and it will never be done the same way again. But the people who are in that room get to hear it. And I had an idea of being able to do that in this sort of cross section of poetry and music that I was working. I mean, the lyric is quite simple, but I feel like when it gets to the resolve, it goes to this G. And for me, that G was huge at the time. It's only like a minute and a half long.
Those were highlights from my conversation with John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats from our March Get Lit with All of It virtual book club event. Here's John Darnielle with a special rendition of Short Song About the 10 Freeway. That was John Darnielle performs as the Mountain Goats with a special rendition of Short Song About the 10 Freeway from our March Get Lit with All of It virtual book club event.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.